I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Millennials, young adults ages 25 to 34, have been revitalizing cities, moving there after college, for work, for community, for bike lanes, the restaurant and music scene, and other urban amenities. And it's certainly true here in Philadelphia. But that doesn't tell the whole story. While the headlines are about carless, hip city dwellers, there are many in that generation who want lawns and quiet and parking spaces and lower rents and are drawn to suburbia. Today on Radio Times, why young adults are looking beyond the city limits. And starting us off is Jed Kulko. He's an independent economist, served as chief economist and vice president of analytics at Trulia, and that's an online real estate site. And Jed Kulko, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So why do we associate millennials with urban living?
There are lots of young people who are choosing to live in incredibly lively urban neighborhoods. When we look at those who have college degrees, bachelor's degrees, and when we look at, you know, places in the centers of big, dense cities like Philadelphia and Brooklyn and San Francisco, there are more of them, there's no question. But most urban neighborhoods are not Brooklyn, and most 25 to 34-year-olds don't have a college degree. And so the perception that we have comes from a particular type of young person, a particular type of neighborhood, which also tends to be the young person and neighborhood that we see TV shows about. You know, these are also often the young people in particular neighborhoods who write about other young people. But when we look across that whole age group, they're actually less likely to live in urban neighborhoods now than they did, than that same age group did in 2000.
So in many ways, we're talking about the forgotten millennials, the ones that aren't getting as much attention as those other millennials you were just talking about.
That's right. Two-thirds of 25 to 34-year-olds don't have a four-year degree. So all of our perceptions that we have based on the college-educated young people we know could be misleading us in terms of, you know, what that broader age group is really doing.
So I guess, I mean, some of them probably do live in cities, the two-thirds without this college degree. Probably some are living at home with their parents, maybe some living in rural America. Are they spread across the country?
They are, and we have seen a lot of growth in the young adult population in mid-size and smaller cities, especially across the South and West. So places like Colorado Springs and San Antonio and Orlando, those are the types of places that have seen the biggest increase in the young adult population, you know, not New York or San Francisco or Washington.
And why is that? What is the appeal of these smaller cities?
Affordability is a big draw. Easier to find a place to rent. And if folks are old enough, easier to find a place to buy. You know, there are also markets that have seen strong job growth. You know, the places in the Midwest where job growth has been slower aren't on that list. You know, so places that have steady job growth and more affordable housing are often really big draws for young adults.
What about, it's often called the inner ring suburbs, and these are the suburbs that circle a city. Certainly Philadelphia has them, other cities have them. Is that a place you might find millennials?
In some markets, yes, absolutely. And I think that's a particularly important type of neighborhood, those inner ring suburbs, not only when we think about different age groups, but also as we think about the growing diversity of the U.S. population. You know, the changes in race and ethnicity, the fact that more and more places are now minority white. One of the places that we're seeing that is these inner suburbs, that, you know, many of which have become incredibly racial and ethnically diverse as the population's changed.
There comes a time, I think, in a young person's life where they, I guess, make a decision about whether they're going to stay in a city or go somewhere else, perhaps the suburbs, perhaps these inner ring suburbs, perhaps some other far-flung place. Is that a pretty typical pattern for a young adult?
It is. And, Marty, you're getting to a really important point, which is there have been lots of other changes that make millennials today different from previous generations of young adults. And the biggest difference is that young adults today are much less likely to be married and have kids than people who were the same age 20, 30 years ago. That's a huge difference. You know, lots of people make the move to the suburbs when they are married, when they have kids, and especially when their kids are turning five, when it's time to think about public schools. Some of these inner suburbs that you mentioned, the inner ring suburbs,
right,
are often popular for folks when they have young kids before they start school, and then when the kids get to age five, is the next move out.
And it sounds like you're saying if millennials are delaying some of these big decisions about either marriage or kids, that decision might come later. We might see millennials starting to leave cities?
That's right. So some of the millennials who are in cities now, you know, the real test is when they have kids turning five. Mm-hmm. That's when we'll know, you know, if there's been, you know, a big change in how people think about cities or not.
I hate using the word millennials, I have to say, because you just sort of hate to talk about people in categories. But I'm a boomer, so I guess I can do that. Are you seeing young people, young adults, looking in rural parts of the country as places to settle down or live?
Less so. You know, during the bubble, there was a big the housing bubble about 10 years ago. There was a big increase in growth in suburban areas and outlying suburbs. There's been an urban rebound since then, but there's been much slower growth in rural areas, particularly for younger adults. So we're really talking more about suburbs than about rural areas.
If you're going to live in the suburbs, you generally need a car. How big a decision is that for a young adult?
Again, a lot depends on whom they're living with. You know, whether, you know, if you're living alone, no kids, much easier to get around without a car, especially in the city, than if you're not. Of course, the decision of where to live and how you get around closely tied together. And there are some parts of the country where you can live much more easily in the suburbs and get around on transit or on bicycle than others.
About house prices or even rental prices. You mentioned, you know, cities like New York and San Francisco where, you know, you can rent a closet for a couple $1,000s a month. Is there a point in which that just becomes unsustainable and makes it impossible to even think about buying a house or saving the money to buy a house?
For lots of young adults, absolutely. Price is a big barrier. And I think it gets to the bigger point that what we see people doing isn't only about what they want. You know, it's also about what they're able to do. And when it comes to whether people choose to live in cities versus suburbs, that's partly a choice, but it also depends on prices, which in turn depends on where we build housing and lots of other public policies. Public policies in lots of cities and at the U.S., for the U.S. overall, typically favor the suburbs when we think about the mortgage interest deduction,
sure,
when we think about how much we've invested historically on highways. You know, these are all things that, you know, have made it cheaper, all else equal, to live in the suburbs than they might have been otherwise. So what we see people doing, whether it's young people living in the suburbs, or people of any age deciding where to live, it's partly about what they deep down really want, but it's also about how a whole set of public policies and other decisions affect what's possible.
You know, I'm thinking you're using the word choose, and I think, you know, for some people, they can choose where to live, and I think for others, they feel like they don't have that choice, and I wonder whether we're still feeling the residual of the recession and the implosion of the economy and the loss of so many jobs and how that has affected young people starting out on a career path.
For young people, the effect of the recession, you know, still being felt in the job market. Young people have gone back to work. Their unemployment rate has come down. but the likelihood that a 25 to 34-year-old has a job and is at work is still lower than it was before the recession. And also, you don't get a job one day and buy a house the next.
Right.
It takes years of saving up, building a credit history, having confidence that that job's going to be there in a year before you make a huge decision like buying a home.
A couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. Do the number of millennials outnumber the number of baby boomers?
So it depends where you draw the line on who actually counts as a millennial or a boomer. I think another way to see this is the most common age right now in the U.S. is 24. There are more 24-year-olds than people of any other age in the U.S. And there are two bulges in the population. One is early to mid-20s, and the other is in the mid-50s. Overall, there are slightly more millennials than there are boomers, but the growth rate of older age groups is faster. In other words, the really big transformation we're going to see over the next 10 years is a huge increase in the number of seniors.
And are baby boomers moving back maybe from the suburbs into cities? We're certainly seeing this in some parts of Philadelphia.
Not in a broader trend. In fact, as people live longer and as people are more likely to have a spouse who's living longer in better health, older folks are staying in single-family homes longer than they used to 20 or 30 years ago.
So looking ahead and even looking at the future of millennials, do you feel good about this group of young adults?
I think there are lots of opportunities. I mean, we've seen that millennials who are graduating today are entering a stronger job market than we've seen in many years. One of the biggest challenges is on the housing affordability side, particularly around rents and rental affordability, particularly in a lot of the places where young adults want to live, is a big, big barrier.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about rents that eat up half or more of a paycheck, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Jed Kolko, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thanks very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Jed Kolko. He's an independent economist. In fact, served as chief economist and vice president of analytics at Trulia. And that's an online real estate site. And we are talking about millennials moving to the suburbs. And we have two guests waiting in the wings. And we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Particularly interested in hearing from the young adults in our audience, 25 to 34. These are the millennials. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we are talking about millennials in the suburbs, and we have two guests who have joined us. Jen Kalaitis is a freelance writer, currently works as a student affairs, at a university in New York, and has written about her love or her missing of the suburbs. And Jen Kalaitis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Michael Caine. He's here with us in our Philadelphia studio. He's a software engineer, former freelance musician, recently made the decision to move from West Philadelphia this summer to Conshohocken, which is just outside of Philadelphia. And Michael Caine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And since you're sitting across from me, you were listening to my interview with our first guest. Why did you make the move?
For me, it was kind of a cost-benefit analysis of living in the city. So you pay a 3% city wage tax to be there. What do you get out of it?
And we should say you lived in the city about 10 years.
Yeah. I lived – when I moved here from Minnesota for graduate school in 2005 and lived in every relatively safe neighborhood since I got here. And, there was benefits to being in the city when I, freelanced a lot as a jazz musician. That's where all the clubs are. So, like walking my vibraphone a mile up from 15th and Tasker to Triss's Jazz Cafe, like that was all right because I didn't have a car.
Right.
I think as you know, my career choices changed, as my priorities changed. You know, the kind of the nitty gritty vibe of Philadelphia proper for me just kind of wore itself out. So I was really interested in getting into, you know, like a neighborhood where, you know, the grass is green and it's clean. It's not trash on the ground all the time, you know. And so I found it in Conshohocken. Yeah.
And we should say to our listeners and also to Jen that Conshohocken is really sort of right on the edge of Philadelphia. So you don't have to go too far to get into the city.
It's like Jed was saying. It's one of those inner ring suburbs. So it's still – you can access the city when you want to, but it's far enough away where you're like, I'm living in Montgomery County. So it's all, you know, a whole different set of rules out there.
Jen, let me get you in on the conversation. You live in Brooklyn, and we know how the rents are in Brooklyn. What is your, I guess, push and pull when it comes to where you want to live at this point in your life?
Sure. Well, it's a lot kind of what Michael was saying, kind of affordability and cost benefits analysis. I moved out to the East Coast. I was in Washington, D.C. for a couple years before living in New York, and I've been here about 3 years now. And for me, moving here right after graduation, I think, has been a really great move for me professionally. But as I look, you know, I'm entering my later 20s now, and as I look kind of onto the future, my priorities may be changing. Right now, I'm kind of paying to have this urban lifestyle, and while I've had quite a bit of fun, and like I mentioned, I think have benefited professionally, I'm not quite sure that's where I'll want to stay. Combination of, again, the affordability, but also, as Michael was saying, green grass, trash-free streets. Those are things that really are, as I'm getting closer to 30, starting to appeal to me.
And is it just you feel like you've done the urban thing, Jen, and now it's time to do something more suburban?
I don't think I'm quite ready for the suburbs yet. I think kind of where I am, I'd like to maybe try a smaller regional city. I'm originally from the Twin Cities area. I grew up in a suburb outside of Minneapolis, and I don't think I'd want to go exactly into that type of lifestyle, you know, very auto-dependent, homogenous, but rather maybe a smaller city like Minneapolis that's more affordable, that still has a lot of the amenities that I enjoy about living in the city. Public transportation, kind of mixed-use neighborhoods, being able to walk to a restaurant for dinner, stuff like that. So I wouldn't say I'm quite ready for what we think of as kind of the quintessential American suburb, but definitely we'll be ready for some sort of change, I think, in the next few years.
And is there a city or a place that fits your definition of what you're looking for?
Yeah, I think that's really Minneapolis. You know, having grown up in the Twin Cities, I really only experienced the suburbs, and now that I have friends who have settled down in either Minneapolis and St. Paul, and, you know, whenever I visit, I've had more of a chance to kind of explore the Twin Cities, and it's really something that appeals to me. I think it kind of does really combine the best of the things that I like about living in New York City with some of the things that I would yearn for living in the suburbs.
Michael, is there anything you've been in Conshohocken for a couple of months, so it's not like you've been out of the city and you're not that far from the city. Are there things you miss, though, or do you have any regrets about making this move?
No, I would say I don't, because, you know, along the lines of what Jen was saying, I think a lot of the things that appealed to me about a city are available in Conshohocken. Fayette Street has got plenty of restaurants you can walk to. There's plenty of culture there, as much as I've experienced in the brief time I've been there. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Conshohocken is unique in that way. I think a lot of suburban areas, like, they get a bad rap, you know, kind of the whole white American dream. You got your picket fence and you have to drive to the mall to do anything. I think
that's not true.
I think a lot of places are changing. Take, for example, like Allentown or the Reading area, and a lot of those places, which are, you know, they're not cities really. They've undergone a lot of development in the downtown areas. But even in like places like that, you have like a main street. Main street's a very kind of rural, you know, suburban concept. Main street's making a comeback. So I think you can get the best of both worlds. You know, public transit notwithstanding, a lot of the cultural aspects of living in a city are certainly available in the suburbs now.
But are you also raising questions about the kind of urban hipster bike riding millennial stereotype?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of with you on that. I feel like we fetishize generations of people, and I think that maybe the kind of the digitalization of culture has kind of lent itself to that. This idea that everybody under 34 is like a blocky glasses wearing weird band listening to tight pants wearing, you know, fixed,
you took the words out of my mouth.
Fixed
go
gear
ahead, Matt,
bicycle
Michael.
Person. Like, that's not the case. Right. And I think, you know, again, I think that Jed was alluding that to that earlier in the earlier segment. The idea that the people that we are discussing, in a lot of cases, we're talking about digital media here, and maybe, you know, Jen can, that's kind of her venue.
Sure.
You're talking about a subset of people talking about a subset of people. Like, we're not talking about the whole generation here. And I think a lot of us are like, you know, yeah, like, you know, Johnny Brendis is great, but like, I'm not hanging out there 3 days a week, and I don't want to live in Fishtown with all the just the dirty grossness of, you know, urban life. It's just so I can catch a good band once every other week. Like, come on, let's be real about who we're talking about.
And here, for outsiders, Johnny Brenda's a, you know, pretty well known music venue in the city. Jen, anything? We got some callers coming in. Anything you want to add to what Michael just said there?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. When we think about millennials, we are largely talking about college-educated urban professionals that kind of came from probably middle-class to upper-middle-class backgrounds. So certainly these trends are not representative of all millennials, as what we heard. I would say I do kind of fit that mold, so I do think I can kind of speak to what kind of the media narratives of millennials are about and kind of how they might be changing in the next coming years.
Well, I should add to you, Jen, and also to our listeners, that our economist that got us started said two-thirds of millennials do not have college degrees, just to kind of put our conversation into context. Jen, let me just read from the very beginning of the article that you had in CityLab. Consider the smell of freshly cut grass, the echo of golden retrievers barking, a pleasant afternoon chat with your neighbor, or alternatively, the ever-present smell of garbage, the blaring of sirens, and the aggravation that seems to come with even the smallest of errands. And I was adding to your bucolic picture of suburbia and the roar of leaf blowers. I mean, it's not like suburbia is nirvana.
Sure, that's definitely a fair point. Certainly, I can think every time I'm home, traffic is something that isn't exactly relaxing. I would say for me, again, I'm kind of comparing two complete extremes, a suburb of the Twin Cities in Minnesota versus New York City. For me, at least, I do think living in New York City can be a little exhausting because of a lot of those extra stressors that I still think you don't quite have as much in the suburbs.
And that's Jen Kaleida. She's a freelance writer, lives in Brooklyn, works at a university in New York. Michael Kane is with us as well. He's a software engineer, recently made the move from West Philadelphia to Conshohocken. And we are talking about millennials and the suburbs, the inner ring suburbs. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. We have emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Matt from West Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So me and my wife, we were living in West Philly, and we were paying those high rents you're talking about. In December, we decided to buy our first house, and we were able to get a place that had a lot of space. Our third floor has 3 bedrooms, a kitchen, and a bathroom, and we have basically grad students from Penn renting those out. It's paying the entire mortgage. So it's just really interesting to hear like all these different things. I'm definitely extreme, and kind of that smell of the clean cut grass, that doesn't appeal to me at all. I love the grit of the city. It's dirty. Yeah, there's sirens, but that's like a soundtrack to my life. And I couldn't be happier in that neighborhood. We're right on 49th and Larchwood.
So you stayed in, you stayed right in West Philadelphia.
Stayed
where
right
you
in
renting.
West Philly. Yep. Moved about 3 blocks from where we were renting.
And I hate to ask you what you paid for it, only because I want to hear from Jen, because we know what it costs to buy things in places like Brooklyn. What did you pay for your house, Matt? Do you feel like
sure? So we paid $315, and actually at the time of purchase, it appraised at $350. And I know you know the report came out last week. We're in that neighborhood that went up 10% in the last year. We're right outside of the Penn Alexander catchment area.
Oh, I know exactly where you're talking about. Jen, you had written about the fact that it's just hard for you even to imagine getting out of the city because you got to figure out you're going to save enough money to make the move.
Certainly. And I think the one good thing about living in New York City is you're kind of spoiled when you go anywhere else for real estate. Kind of just to give you an example of what we're looking at, if I were to ever think about buying property here, a writer for Brooklyn, it's a Brooklyn-based blog, did the math, and he could buy a spacious condo in Cleveland for the same price, he could buy a one-bedroom condo in Clinton Hill in Brooklyn for $500,000, and for that same price could buy a condo double the size in Cleveland, which includes a washer and dryer. So for anyone listening in New York, you know what that value is.
Sure.
And with all the leftover cash, could travel to New York City every weekend for 10 years. That includes your airfare and your lodging. So for me, yes, I just don't know how anyone who's middle class or even upper middle class could afford to really buy in this market in New York.
Well, and Michael, I mean, we're lucky in Philadelphia. We haven't reached that kind of a housing market yet. But as you were saying, it was a cost benefit analysis for you. You figured it would be financially smart to move to outside of the city.
Yeah, and you know, I used to live at 50th and Cedar, right around the corner from where the caller lives.
Oh,
so
sure.
As I appreciate. You know, like that neighborhood is kind of up and coming as far as – but cost-benefit analysis for me, like I'm a contractor. So when my contract's up, like I don't know if I have a job. My next job might be in New York or might be in D.C. or Baltimore somewhere. So the idea that just the kind of the scarcity in my field of permanent employment – like I can't, like it'd be suicide to buy a house because
right.
What's the sense of buying a house right. You can't pay for if you don't have a job?
Yeah, exactly. Let me get that. Looks like Greg from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So what I feel like is kind of getting neglected in this conversation is just the sheer amount of boredom and repetitiveness that actually comes with living in the suburbs. And while sure, the benefits of green grass and friendly neighbors and things like that are certainly high, you know, at the end of the day, you're pretty limited to your options in terms of food, shopping, where you're going to go, where you're going to work. And your neighbors, as friendly as they can be, tend to be at least 10 years older than you anyway. So this whole idea that millennials moving out to the suburbs and kind of finding a better deal than living in the city, you know, while it sounds nice, I think that there's a lot of things that people don't take into account, like, you know, your options for food out here are generally fast food, and you're going to be driving at least a half hour to get to anywhere remotely, you know, interesting, cultural, or fun.
Well, you know, Greg,
in Bucks County.
Let me stop you there, only because I'm pretty familiar with Doylestown and some of the restaurants there, so I'm surprised to hear you say that. But let me give Michael Caine a chance to respond.
Yeah, I guess I get a little bit confused when people talk about, like, these flourishing, you know, social lives that everybody has. Like most of the time, the people my generation, like you're either at home binging on a Netflix or you have like your two little dive bars you go to with your urban tribe. So this – and again, we're back to like the kind of the stereotypical approach to the suburbs. There are great restaurants walking distance from my house. Like there's a really – there's a place called El Limon. It's amazing taqueria. There's like two Thai joints like right – walking distance from my house. Like so this idea that we don't have choices, it's kind of ridiculous to me because there's plenty of choice where I live. And, in Doylestown, when I was a freelance musician, there was a club called Puck. Had great live music all the time. There's a couple of record labels out there that host live music. You got to go looking for it. It's not like you've got a whole strip like we have in Fishtown that just stumble into good music. But, like, you know, you can make a little bit of effort. You're going
to
find something.
Let me squeeze one more caller on before we have to end the conversation. We have Erica from Bethlehem joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Erica. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to share the sentiment that it seems that your contributors have. I lived between Philadelphia and San Francisco for 10 years up until about 6 months ago. I made the transition out to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And I have to say, when I'm in the city, I absolutely miss the city. But when I'm not there, which is more often than when I am there, I don't miss having to find parking. Am I going to be able to get to the grocery store and have the same spot? Can I carry my groceries up my four flights of stairs? So I just, I'm 30, I'm just about to be 32. So I think maybe sometimes it is almost, for many of us, that rite of passage. Your priorities change. You're thinking less about the best restaurants and best bars to get to, and you're starting to think maybe more about raising a family.
Well, Erica, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jen, let me give you a chance to weigh in on what Erica was just saying.
I certainly agree. I mentioned before that living in New York City and, of course, San Francisco, which is even more expensive, you're really paying for a certain lifestyle that probably, I would assume, becomes less and less appealing as you get older. I moved out to the East Coast in my early 20s, and I'm 27 now, and I can already tell that my priorities have shifted. And certainly as I look into the future in the next few years and the possibility of having kids, it's really a no-brainer for me.
And do you feel, I mean, based a little bit on what you were saying earlier, Mike, I mean, do you feel like you, at this point in your life, you have to be mobile because of career opportunities or just
sure.
where you are in your life?
Yeah, and I think there's an element of practicality to that, too. You know, I still play as a musician on the weekends. So the idea that I'm going to go to a club and they're going to have all the gear there for me is like, that doesn't really exist. I guess... You know, like we're talking about priorities, and you know, I think again we're back to like the fetishization of younger people. Like, I don't think you would have made any different choices that we're making if you were our age in the time in which we live. So this idea that we're like millennials are so weird and making all these weird choices, like no, we're trying to do the same stuff y'all were doing 30 years ago. Just the rules of the game are a little different. But at the end,
headline, right?
Exactly. So it's like I think we have a lot more in common than we do have differently. So this looking at like the millennial generation as this like weird thing, like, ooh, what are they going to do next? How do we get them to buy a car? How do we get them to buy a house? They got weird priorities. Like, no, like this, we're trying to find our way in the world as young people, just the way you guys did in the 60s and the 70s. It's just our landscape looks a little different, but the choices, I think, if you were us, would be the same.
Well, I wish we could go on because it's a great conversation. Michael Caine, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Software engineer moved from West Philadelphia to Conshohocken this summer. Jen Kalaitis, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's a freelance writer living in Brooklyn. And go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to carry on the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We now turn to the world of pop music. Radio Times producer John Ahrens recently discussed the mechanisms of hit songs with New Yorker writer John Seabrook, author of a book called The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. Let's listen.
For Radio Times, I'm producer John Ahrens. The music industry has undergone a lot of changes in the past 50 years, but one thing has remained constant, the desire to make big, undisputable hit songs. And now, more than ever, with an overabundance of free music online, the music industry relies on big hits and hit makers to turn a profit. In his new book, The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory, New Yorker writer John Seabrook examines the modern-day pop landscape. Not only does he profile the careers of our current crop of pop stars, people like Katy Perry, Rihanna, and Kelly Clarkson, he also demystifies the people behind the songs. John Seabrook joins us now to help us understand the process behind making a hit song and why the songs on the radio sound the way they do. John Seabrook, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks, John.
I want to begin by talking about the current go-to man for a surefire hit song. He goes by Max Martin, and he's penned more Billboard number one hits than the Beatles and more than Michael Jackson, currently totaling 21 hits. Here's some examples of number ones that Max Martin has been involved in. Now, do you think it's surprising to most listeners that one man, and one they've likely never heard of, is behind all of these songs?
I think it is surprising because, you know, I think they make an effort to keep that under wraps. I mean, I think the experience of the song is more moving if you think that the singer wrote the song and is singing from his or her heart. So it doesn't really help in terms of selling the song to let people know that somebody else wrote it. From the point of view of Max Martin and his colleagues, they would like you to be surprised to find out that, you know, Taylor Swift or Katy Perry didn't write all of those songs.
Well, it's funny, though, that you say that, people wanting to think that the singer is singing their own song. I mean, because this idea and people like Max Martin, they're nothing new. And you point that out in your book, I mean, you say there are previous hit factories like Tin Pan Alley, the Brill Building, Motown, and Philadelphia's own Gamble and Huff.
Right.
So why do you think it is off-putting to people that someone is writing songs for these people? And where did that idea originate that, you know, the singer is writing their own song?
Well, clearly the singer-songwriter era was the origin of that idea. And that, you know, I would say probably lasted from, you know, 1963, whenever the Beatles, the beginning of the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles were the huge change, right? Because suddenly here was a group that was writing their own songs that were competing on the pop charts with the Brill Building writers. And so you had, you know, a whole generation of people that basically got used to the idea that, you know, the artists did write their own songs. And from a marketing point of view, I think it's great for selling the music. Even when the era kind of waned and when, you know, the singer-songwriters were no longer making hits and it turned more to a Brill Building-like system the way it was before, I think the difference is that it had been preceded by the singer-songwriter era, you know, people wanted to kind of keep the marketing value of that going.
Going back to this Max Martin guy, who is he and how did he get started in the business?
So, yeah, Max Martin, whose real name is Carl Martin Sandberg, started out as a performer, actually. He was in a glam metal band in the 80s. He listened to a lot of Kiss when he was a teenager, and then he decided he wanted to be in a band, and he became the front man of this metal band called It's Alive. It's actually definitely worth calling up the video of Pretend I'm God, which was their biggest song. Max is the front man, and he kind of enacts this crucifixion. Kind of amazing that this incredibly anonymous person today is actually sort of an exhibitionist at that point. And then they went to get a record contract. They signed with this Swedish DJ who called himself Dennis Pop. The record never went anywhere. The band never went anywhere. But Dennis Pop realized that Max Martin had a songwriting gift and put him to work in the studio. At that point, Ace of Base had just had their huge hits, and that really put Dennis Pop's studio, which was called Sharon, on the map. The Backstreet Boys were coming along next, and Max Martin started writing songs for the Backstreet Boys, so his first hits were actually songs like I Want It That Way.
One thing that struck me as particularly interesting, I mean, you just mentioned Dennis Pop, and we're talking about Max Martin, who are Swedish. Also profiled in your book is the Norwegian duo Stargate, who make tracks for Rihanna, and they did the Black and Yellow song by Wiz Khalifa.
Right.
Is there something about Scandinavians and their musical sensibility that connects so well to pop music fans all over the world?
I think there's a couple of reasons Scandinavians do well in this particular genre. I mean, in terms of being sort of behind-the-scenes songwriters and not being the artists on stage, I think Scandinavians are particularly suited to that because there's this whole kind of code of not putting yourself forward. Individual celebrity is somewhat frowned upon. There's a word for it, jantelagen, and the laws of jante. But I think a more important element here is, you know, people are always trying to combine R&B and pop and produce a sound that is a new hybrid of a black and white sound. But I think in the States, because those categories, those musical categories, R&B and pop, have emerged from, you know, racist categories, white and black, segregation. The music was segregated. It was called race records before it was called R&B. And I think if you're a white writer in America and you want to write R&B, you're just going to have a kind of a hard time of it. Whereas if you're Swedish or if you're Norwegian, you don't have the racial legacy of those distinctions, those musical distinctions. So I think that's actually what Max Martin set out to do. He set out to write R&B songs, but because he was Swedish, they didn't come out exactly like R&B songs sound to us, but they combined you know, an R&B kind of vibe with a kind of a Europop vibe, and I think that's the real key to their success.
So a lot of your book, you describe how songs are made these days, and you almost equate the process to an assembly line. Can you walk us through that assembly line?
Yeah, I think the big difference between the way songs are made today and the way they used to be made is today's method is a method I call in the book track and hook. And what that means is that in the old days you had a melody writer and you had a lyric writer and you sat around the piano and you smoked a bunch of cigarettes and you sort of banged out a tune. These days, a song starts with a track, which is, you know, the beats, the rhythm track, plus the instrumentation, which is almost all done on the computer. So it essentially starts with the production, whereas in the old days, the song would have been produced after it was written. These days, the song is kind of produced first, and then you get what they call a top-line writer to come in and listen to a bunch of tracks. You can make a lot of different tracks at the same time, and that's what most of these guys do. And you get a top-line writer to come in and listen to some, and then they hear one that inspires them or they like, and they go into the booth. And a lot of it is just kind of done on the mic, looking for a hook. I watched this happen on several different occasions and described how it happens in the book. And it really starts kind of sub-verbally with just almost sort of syllable sounds and nonsense sounds that go with the music, and then there's a hook that comes out and words come out. And then once you have the hook, then you're basically 80% there. And then the rest of it is basically, okay, now let's write a verse and let's write a chorus. And then maybe at the end you write the bridge and the song is done. And maybe only one of the songs that you make out of 20 or 30 ends up on a record, but it doesn't really matter because it doesn't really take that long to make them. You can make a lot of them pretty quickly, and chances are you're going to have one that's pretty good. And that's how the songs are made today.
So one of the top liners, that's the person who writes the vocal melody that you said begins subverbally with just guttural sounds and yelling and like a syllabic framework. Is that right?
Right.
So one of these people you talk about is Esther Dean. Can you tell me how she was discovered?
Yeah, Esther Dean is a fabulous character that maybe more people know through her work in the two Pitch Perfect movies. She started out as a top line writer and is at the very top of the top line writing game. So
she works with Rihanna primarily.
Yeah, she wrote Rude Boy.
Come here, rude boy, boy, can you get it up? Come here, rude boy, boy, is she big enough?
So Esther really had no musical background and was living in Atlanta working as a nurse's aide in a hospital. And she went to a Gap Band show one night, and she knew all the words to the songs, and she was singing along. And the producer, Tricky Stewart, happened to be in the audience as well, and he heard this person singing along with Charlie Wilson, who's the main singer in the Gap Band. And he thought to himself, damn, you know, that person can sing. And so he kind of like followed the voice through the crowd, and it led him to, you know, the mouth of Esther Dean. And he said to her, have you ever had any musical training, ever written any songs? And she said, no. And he said, well, I think you should come to the studio, you know, tomorrow and try it out. And it turned out she was kind of a hook writing savant. You know, they could put her on the mic and out would come this amazing hook. So they signed her to a publishing deal, and that was her start. And she's just gone on to incredible success.
But one success that eludes her is being a pop star herself, which she actually kind of wants. So despite the fact that she can sing and she can write and she's got this bold personality that you describe in the book, what differentiates somebody like that from someone becoming an actual big star?
Yeah, this is a super interesting dynamic in the whole songwriting business. Most of the top line writers want to be artists, but from the point of view of the established artists and the people around those artists, the last thing they want is for the top songwriters to be artists, because then they're going to take their own songs and sing them themselves rather than give them to Rihanna or to Katy Perry. So there's this kind of institutional wall that you run into as a top line writer. And that's part of the reason that Esther hasn't been able to be a successful artist. But being an artist these days isn't really necessarily all about or even half about the singing. It's about the performing. It's about being beautiful. It's about having your picture taken. It's about being able to take on different personalities and different songs. Rihanna's really good at this, you know, sound like a totally different person from song to song. It's almost like you're acting in a role. You're an actor, and the song is your script. And that's a quality that I don't think Esther is as skilled at as Rihanna. And, you know, she doesn't really look like Rihanna. So that kind of holds her back a little bit, I think.
So I'm wondering, how nefarious do you find all of this? And I'll say I spent several years trying to pursue a career as a hit songwriter. And I was never seeking to exploit anybody or to, you know, rake in the big bucks. It was mainly out of a love of finely structured 3-minute pop song. But, you know, the Atlantic published a review, you know, saying called the hit charade of your book and made it sound much more devious. How devious do you find all of this?
I mean, so let's back up a little bit here, John. There's a long tradition going back to Theodore Adorno of viewing, you know, mass culture and the industry of mass culture as essentially, if not a conspiracy to keep people sort of dumb and happy, than a very cynical enterprise of pushing crap that will appeal to the lowest common denominator just to make a buck. And so when people hear that their songs are not written by the artists and, you know, that there's this somewhat manipulated approach to writing songs, then they sort of make this big leap and say, oh, so it's all a big charade and it's all smoke and mirrors and these people don't have any talent. But that's not what I'm saying. And as you pointed out, you know, Frank Sinatra didn't write his own songs. Billie Holiday didn't write her own songs. You know, Strange Fruit was written by a little Jewish radical poet in the Bronx.
So to wrap up, what makes a hit song?
Yeah, you know, that's a funny thing, John. It's like I wrote this book. I spent 3.5 years working on it. And if I could tell you what makes a hit song, I would basically never have to write another thing in my life. I would just make hit songs. I do know the people who are successful, particularly the protégés of Max Martin, the protégés that he's found and trained, are all people who did not come from the pop world. So they're the people that are out on the edges actually innovating musically. But then there's someone else who's older than them who hears that and who's maybe looking for that edge themselves and brings them in and teaches them how to apply it to pop music. And that's when the hits come out.
John Seabrook is New Yorker writer and author of The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. John Seabrook, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Awesome, John. It was really fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
And for more information about Radio Times and to tell us what you think of the show, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.